All right. So our speaker today, as I said before, is Eleanor Morley. So Eleanor is a leading socialist activist and political economist from Sydney and a member of Socialist Alternative. And they'll be speaking today. So take it away, Morley. Eleanor.
Thanks, Jahil. And thanks, comrades, for inviting me to speak today. And just want to say congratulations on what looks to have been a really, really, really brilliant conference so far. So well done to everyone who's put it together and everyone who's been showing up and participating in all of the discussions. But to move on to trying to explain what the hell is happening in the world economy. So on the 17th of November, 2019, a 55-year-old from Hubei province in China checked themselves into hospital with signs of pneumonia. So this seemingly simple act kicked off a chain of events that in 4 months' time would result in the steepest and most sudden economic shock since the Great Depression, as the world went into lockdown in country after country and the economy screeched to a halt. So between March and May of this year, 40 million people in the United States lost their jobs. The price of oil slipped from $60 to less than $20 per barrel. Across Europe, another 40 million workers were furloughed, where the state essentially paid a section of or all of their wage. Here in Australia, the tourism industry was losing $3 billion a month, and more than 10,000 workers have been or have lost their jobs in the airline industry alone. In the United Kingdom, the economy contracted by 20% in the second quarter of this year and by 25% in India. And there are similar facts and figures in country after country over that initial period of 2020. So in response to this, we've also seen the biggest state stimulus measures, the biggest state spending ever, or at least in peacetime, which have been implemented to try and stave off a total global crash. So the American government spent $2 trillion in late March, which was then matched by another $2.3 trillion by the Federal Reserve. This July, the European Union announced an $850 billion package, which is on top of stimulus spending within European countries themselves. In Australia, by the end of March, there had been $213 billion in federal government spending, almost $13 billion from the state governments, and $105 billion in lending from the Reserve Bank and the federal government. So these all well and truly eclipse the enormous stimulus spending in response to the global financial crisis. And they came much, much more quickly this time round, managing for now at least to kind of hold the cracks in the economy together. So it was the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic that precipitated this.
As a political economist.
Importantly, there were, I think someone might need to be muted. There were already underlying weaknesses in the global economy, and understanding these are crucial to understanding the global economy today. So to understand all of this, we need to start by looking back over the recent history of the capitalist economy. So the neoliberal period, the global financial crisis and its recovery, and then importantly, the very shaky economic situation heading into the pandemic. So I'm going to try go through these things in this talk, ending with where we're at today. Okay, and I'm going to explain this within the framework of Marx's theory of economic crisis. So Marx argued that capitalism is a system of a recurrent boom and bust cycle. So during the boom, a frenzy of economic activity leads to high investment, low unemployment, and an enormous increase in output. So much so, actually, that it reaches a point where what has been produced, too much has been produced that can be profitably sold. So the system starts to wind down, leading to the next slump. In the slump, investment is wound back, unemployment rises, and growth rates start to reverse. Until the bosses that have survived the slump take advantage of low wages and low commodity prices to kick off new rounds of investment that produce the next boom. But Marx also argued that underlying these recurrent cycles is a long-term tendency for the rate of profit to decline. So profits are the lifeblood of capitalism. They're what makes the system move for the capitalists. So over time, the dynamism of capitalism begins to weaken as the rate of profit decline, leading to greater slumps, weaker booms, and periodic crashes in the economy that open up moments of very deep crisis for global capitalism. So this tendency is not just a linear drop down at all times. It can go up and down. It's a long-term tendency. And it can be offset by a series of counteracting factors, for instance, increasing the exploitation of the working class, a favourite of theirs, almost effectively the clearing out effect of crisis itself that I mentioned earlier. But eventually the decline in the rate of profit will once again reassert itself. And we can see this dynamic on display in the global economy since the end of the long boom, which ended in the 1970s. So the recessions of the 1970s and 1980s gave way to the neoliberal recovery, and this is the world that we have just inherited. So key aspects of neoliberalism have included a massive increase in the exploitation of workers, the deregulation of financial markets, earlier on the opening up of new markets such as those in Eastern Europe and China, and an increase in international trade. So these things, amongst some others, eventually pulled the global economy out of the slump and started a new cycle of growth. But this new cycle was very weak compared to historical standards. So the rate of profit only ever rose to about half of that which it had been during the post-war boom. And partly this is because a phenomenon that the British Marxist Chris Harman called too big to fail. So as individual firms under capitalism get kind of bigger and bigger and more hegemonic over time, they make up a much, much greater portion of the economy. And in times of recession or economic crisis, what we've seen, especially since the 70s, is nation states step in to protect firms from going bust. So firms that are relatively unprofitable, that have low rates of productivity, etc., that might otherwise be wiped out in the wash up of crisis. Governments don't want that to happen because they don't want to weaken their economy as against their competitors internationally, and also don't want to deal with the political crises that result from such a crash. Okay, so during the neoliberal period, the twin processes of this frontal assault on workers and privatising and deregulating everything on the books led to, on the one hand, an enormous increase in global inequality. For instance, in the US, over the course of three decades, up until the GFC, the richest 1% nearly doubled their share of national earnings, while over a quarter of the population came to live on poverty wages. And this is similar right around the world. But on the other hand, the increased wealth of capitalists itself created an incendiary economic situation. So in response to the historically lower rate of profit, there was an explosion in the financial sector where deregulation led to the creation of new and increasingly risky financial products and a drive to securitize everything. That is to transform debt into financial instruments that could be publicly traded. So the recovery peaked in around 1997, but then started to run into a series of problems. So the East Asian crisis of the late 90s, then the bursting of the dot-com bubble in the early 2000s, that was a big warning sign at the time. But low interest rates, the government implementing low interest rates, prevented the US from entering into crisis then, but only by pushing the economy forward with an explosion of debt. So capital investment in new plants and the means of production was slow and attention was instead turned towards the most profitable sectors, which were finance, housing and construction. But then this all obviously came tumbling down in 2008, and the spark for the crash was famously the US housing market. So in the lead up to the global financial crisis, large amounts of debt, largely housing debt or mortgage debt, were repackaged. So all different ones kind of packaged together in these things called collateralized debt obligations, and then traded in increasingly complicated ways through the financial giants. So the profitability of this for financial firms then encouraged predatory subprime mortgage lending. So lenders signing mortgages without doing credit checks with interest rates that were really low to begin with, but that would then rise really sharply after 2 years to people who would, you know, never be able to afford that in the future when the rates started to change, especially when house prices started to decline. And partly this was like people just wanting to get a house for their family, but there was also investors that jumped on this and, you know, bought up 5, 6, whatever properties that they had no ability to maintain when it started to go backwards. So the housing bubble burst in 2007, as bubbles do, followed by a stock market crash, the failure of some of the largest US investment banks, plummeting commodity prices, a freezing of credit, and a slowing down of international trade. So it kicked off in the United States and then spread throughout some other parts of the world, mainly Europe and parts of Latin America. It's worth noting, though, that at the time, that crisis was not totally global. Some places remained more immune, largely because of the economic powerhouse of China, which through, again, enormous stimulus spending, but also massive amounts of investment and growth leading up to that period, managed to kind of ride the wave of that period. And then other countries like Australia, whose economies are quite reliant on China, kind of were held up through that period as well. Okay, but in the places that were affected, it's important to note that it is, or it was the working class who paid for the crisis, not the people at the top who caused it. So in the US, more than 9 million homes were foreclosed. Between July and November of 2008, the number of families entering homeless shelters in New York City jumped by 40% compared to the previous year. And this was mirrored in cities right across the country. Meanwhile, whole housing estates that had been built in the last years of the construction boom just stood empty, like the, emptied like ruins of an abandoned civilization or something, whole housing estates in the United States, Spain, and elsewhere. Over 8 million jobs were lost, and by the end of 2009, almost 30 million people, or 18% of the workforce, were either unemployed, underemployed, or had given up looking for work. And then in the years that followed came the austerity packages. So these stripped back almost all of the aspects of the welfare state that had managed to kind of cling on and survive the preceding 30 years of neoliberal attacks. And there was a very, very real human face to this aspect of the crisis. So a report came out last year by a social welfare NGO that calculated 130,000 deaths in the United Kingdom since 2012 could have been prevented were it not for the government's austerity measures. In Greece, the pointy end of the austerity stick, the suicide rate rose by 35% in the first few years. And there's movies like I, Daniel Blake and 99 Homes that kind of encapsulate the immense human suffering and misery that came out of the crisis and the way that governments and bosses responded to it. Okay, but then after this, a recovery did begin. To be clear though, this has been a recovery experienced in corporate boardrooms, not by the poor and workers, students, etc., the world over. So the recovery was first fueled by massive bailouts of the banks. The government essentially bought their shitty debt off them and moved it onto their own books through massive stimulus spending for corporate America, through the printing of cheap money, flooding markets with money in a process known as quantitative easing, and through historically low interest rates to try and encourage people to not keep their money in a bank or so on, but to go and invest it. And all of this has added to the enormous debt burden that already existed before the crisis. There's also been, surprise, surprise, more attacks on the working class. So there's the austerity that I mentioned before, but also wages have been held down. So even when jobs started to make a comeback, when they did, it was largely on the basis of adding poorly paid temporary and part-time work. So the rich got very, very wealthy over the past decade, astonishingly astonishingly wealthy. The share of wealth going to the top 10% increased to 75% over this period. But still, none of this has sufficiently been able to restore profitability and create the conditions for the next boom. So the last decade has been characterized by historically anemic growth rates, low growth rates. And to return to Marx's crisis theory to explain this, or those clearing out effects of the crisis, which then kickstart the next boom, have just not happened on... Am I frozen? Okay. All right. So I think I was explaining why the recovery was so weak. So back to Marx's crisis theory, and that the clearing out effects that can lead from a crisis to the next boom just have not happened over the past decade. So the bailouts have been holding up sections of the economy that would have gone under. Low or in some places negative interest rates have allowed essentially unprofitable firms to keep their doors open. And the low rate of profit has continued to encourage speculation in the finance sector over investment in the productive economy. So the recovery peaked in about 2017, but since then entered into a steady decline. So I'm going to move on to talking about the state of the global economy heading into the pandemic, because it wasn't looking very good. So by the end of 2019, leading economists globally were warning that the world was at risk of another recession, and one that could be as bad as the crash of 2008 to 2009. And there was a whole bunch of different indicators that suggested this. So first of all was growth rates. In the advanced economies, growth was very low, so 1.2% in the Eurozone, down from 1.9% the year before. This was even lower in the United Kingdom and Japan, a little higher in the United States, but still only 2%. And all the pre-pandemic predictions for 2020 were that there would be lower growth this year, even than last year. The problem was also apparent in emerging markets, which were, you know, supposed to be the new economic powerhouses propelling the global economy forward. So China had a growth rate of 6.2%, which is comparatively high, but compared to the, you know, 12-13% of just a few years earlier, are starting to decline. Same in India, 5.8% from a peak in 9% 4 years ago. And then in Mexico, Russia and Turkey, the economy is just flatlined or just below 1%. Finally, Argentina actually shrank 5.5% in 2018 to 2019. So in addition to this, foreign trade had flatlined. Profits, both the rate of profit and the mass of profits had decreased. And there was a manufacturing recession. So industrial production in the advanced economies went backwards. Also by 2019, debt had swelled to record high levels. So this was true of household debt, you know, where people are being forced to take out loans for an education, you know, to get a car, sometimes just to pay rent and buy groceries. But it's been most startling with corporate and state debt, both increased by more than 30% as of 2019 from the decade prior to it. So by last year, corporate debt stood at $72 trillion globally, or 92% of global GDP. And this was fueled by the low interest rates and the printing of money. One kind of other worrying aspect of the economy for leading economists has been the existence or predominance of zombie companies. So these are firms that are essentially unprofitable. They are just making enough money to kind of pay for new inputs and service their debt, but nothing more than that. And companies like this are very vulnerable to slight shifts or an economic downturn, or a rise, even a small rise, in interest rates. Because, you know, if their debt goes up slightly, they can't afford to pay any of it back. Also, these companies help keep productivity low because they're unable to, you know, invest in new machinery, new things to kind of expand industry and turn things around. They're just kind of stagnating and holding ground. And sorry, I'm not sure if I said this, but in America, it was predicted that by the start of this year, 1 in 5 or 20% of American firms were kind of in this category. So the outlier to all of this was the financial markets, which actually were continuing to boom. But this in and of itself highlights the instability of global markets. And earlier this week, I rewatched The Big Short, which is a really fascinating movie made a few years ago about the couple of years leading up to the global financial crisis and the predatory lending that was going on. And there's this bit right at the end of the movie in the like chaos of the days following the collapse of Lehman Brothers, where two of these investment bankers who are presented as the ones kind of with a conscience, they're talking to each other over the phone when they've just heard about the state bailouts and realised that the entire thing had been a stitch up and there was never any risk involved for the people responsible for making those decisions. Anyway, one of them says to the other one over the phone, he goes, "But at least we're going to see some of them go to jail, right? They're going to have to break up the banks now. Surely the party is over." And then the other guy down the other end of the phone says, "I don't know. I have a feeling that in a few years, people are going to be doing what they always do when the economy tanks. They will be blaming immigrants and poor people." And I found that fascinating because it just about sums up what did happen following the crisis. So when Obama came to power just after the crisis hit, he promised, you know, we're going to get Wall Street in check. It's unfair. It's gone on for too long. He then proceeded to install the former heads of the financial giants into his administration and as his financial assistants and stuff like that. And also refused to properly regulate financial markets. Only a few small things here and there, but nothing major. And then also think about so much of the kind of ruling class ideology of the past decade. First of all, you know, poor people who were just greedy and wanted to buy a house they couldn't afford. The refugee crisis in Europe 5 years ago, you know, it's all these people from the Middle East who want to steal your jobs and your homes. You know, ignore the continued austerity of our governments. Anyway, so kind of a sidestep, but what all of this means is that the financial markets have been able to propel themselves forwards using the same, more or less the same kind of mechanisms that they did last time round. So profit rates have remained low. So the cheap money that states have flooded the economy with has been spent on the stock market, often with companies buying their own shares to inflate their price, making them more attractive to other investors. And again, with more risky borrowing. So the collateralized debt obligations of a decade ago have become the collateralized loan obligations, where it's largely shitty corporate debt and student loans and stuff like that that's being repackaged and sold throughout the financial markets. And all of this is totally out of touch with the productive economy. And I think there's one example that really highlights this, and it's Apple, the company Apple, most profitable company in the US. In 2019, their profits declined by 8%, yet at the same time, their stock valuation went from $700 billion to $1.4 trillion. So this is unstable and certainly unsustainable. Okay, so moving on to the pandemic. Like I began with, the initial economic figures from the first wave of the pandemic and lockdowns were staggering. And while economists were predicting at the end of 2019, predicting an imminent recession, no one could have predicted that this is exactly how it would play out. So early on, most political leaders were saying the second quarter figures would be a small blip that would then quickly give way to a V-shaped recovery. But I think it's pretty obvious now that this is not going to happen. At the same time, though, there has not just been a total global crash. I think the enormous stimulus spending has prevented that from happening. It's not like the financial sector's fallen apart. There's been, you know, mass bankruptcies everywhere. We haven't seen that kind of stuff on a very large scale yet. So since, you know, roughly March and April, the tempo of crisis and recovery has been uneven globally. And largely dependent, I think, on two factors. One is the degree to which the pandemic has been brought under control. And two, the wiggle room each state has to spend big to stave off crisis. And I just want to quickly look at some different parts of the world and how things are going there. First is the developed countries. So the IMF predicts that the combined stimulus so far is 20% of GDP. There's been a $7 trillion increase in the central bank assets of the G7 countries in just 8 months. For an interesting comparison, it was just $3 trillion in the entire year following the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008. So early on in the lockdown, the US Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said, you're going to really see the economy bounce back in July, August and September. Interestingly enough, a lot of the advanced economies did somewhat bounce back in those 3 months as the first wave had subsided, the lockdowns ended, the economies opened up again, the government spent a lot of money, etc. But they're, you know, right across Europe, North America, the failure to lock down, the failure to implement effective health measures has led to an explosion of new coronavirus cases. Which is, you know, dire and criminal in terms of human life. It will also be dire for their economy. And still, less than half of those in America, at least, who lost their jobs in the first few months are being re-employed. In the Eurozone, the European Commission has already had to lower its growth forecast for 2021. Because of the new wave of COVID and now reluctant from the state, but the return of lockdowns. So in the emerging, what are called the emerging economies, places like Argentina, Brazil, China, Mexico, Turkey, and elsewhere, IMF predicts that they've spent roughly 6 to 7% of GDP in their stimulus measures, which has helped a bit, but the situation's pretty bad in a whole bunch of these places. So it's the first time on record that these countries combined will suffer a contraction of GDP. And that is even with China included in the figures. So India, which is suffering enormously from the pandemic, is facing GDP losses of 10%, Mexico and South Africa 9%, and Brazil 6%. And then even in China, where the pandemic first spread, but where it was also relatively quickly brought under control, because of that reason, the economies bounced back there more than in other places. They recorded growth in the second quarter and in this half of the year. But it's like very, very, very small numbers compared to the past few decades. So just a bit over 1%. In addition to that, China has its own debt problems. So China's debt to GDP ratio reached 256% in mid-2017, which is higher than America's. And that certainly has increased in the 3 years since those figures were taken. So whether or not China will be able to play the same role as it did following the GFC, I think is yet to be seen. Okay, but where things get really, really bad right now is in the low-income countries. So they've only been able to spend roughly 2% of their already much smaller national incomes, which has left their economies much more vulnerable to a long-term slump and will likely push millions more into poverty. So already UNICEF predicts that around 150 million additional children are now living in abject poverty due to the pandemic. Six low-income countries have defaulted on or restructured their debts since the pandemic began, and more are likely to follow. So the international financial institutions, which these countries are indebted to, have been scrambling to try change the rules of the game a bit to try stop debt crises erupting in country after country after country. But it is absolutely inconceivable that these institutions, you know, on behalf of the corporations and the countries they represent, will oversee the kind of debt forgiveness these countries need. So the situation in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere, I think, is looking pretty dire heading into the next couple of years. Just briefly want to say something about Australia, because this year we've experienced our first recession in 30 years. So also the drop was pretty large here in the first few months of the year. But I think there's some, you know, some things that pull in the other direction in Australia as well. Firstly is the relative control of the pandemic that we've got here. Obviously, Victoria was the outlier for a while, but now COVID's effectively been eliminated in that state, which has allowed the economy to move again in a way that it's not in other parts of the world. But also, I think the fact that there was no recession for so many years mean that the kind of financial institutions and the government have had quite a large ability to intervene directly into the economy, pump money into Australian corporations and business, as we saw with the budget, and kind of stave off a big crisis here for now. Although in saying that, I think there are still some potential weak spots. So there's clearly a lot of insolvent firms that are still operating. So firms that can't even really meet their debt obligations. You know, we're still yet to see what happens when JobKeeper subsidies are ended and when JobSeeker is brought back to its original totally poverty levels. Also, what happens when people who got mortgage holidays, rental reductions and stuff like that, when that starts to turn around. So there are some, you know, problem moments ahead in the future here as well. But in general, I think at this stage, it's hard to draw strict conclusions about exactly where we're heading in a month or a year. But what we can say is that capitalism is in a deep crisis. It's not just the recession caused by the pandemic, but also a long-term crisis of profitability. And there is no obvious or easy way out for the system. So there's more things that they can do, more state spending, attack the working class more, and so on. But none of this can sufficiently restore the rate of profit in the foreseeable future. Also, some of the other underlying problems not just remain, but have been made worse this year. So in the stock markets, again, like after a mammoth drop in February and March, which seemed to be kind of correcting how out of kilter that was with the productive economy, it's totally turned around and soared once again. And this is still so out of touch with reality and a moment of reckoning that will come at some point. So it's kind of like the problems that led to the GFC, which were then used to deal with the GFC, which have led to the next crisis, are now being used again to deal with this crisis. Or a like simple way that the British Marxist economist Michael Roberts put it was credit has been piled on credit and the only solution is more credit. Okay, but to conclude, just a few other political points to draw out of this situation. Because the state that the global economy is in will have effects well beyond like what the stock market is doing or what GDP growth is and isn't. First of all, there's the rising imperialist tensions that we're seeing globally. So between the two major powers, the US and China, the increased hostility between those two over recent years was definitely partly impacted and then impacts on the state of the economy over the past decade. So China being able to rise out of the global financial crisis quicker and surge ahead has put it much more quickly into kind of locking horns, or the United States and the rest of the West locking horns with it. And I think that's a dynamic that's only going to increase in the coming years. Also, we've seen this year more tensions between sub-imperialist powers, you know, more tensions on contested borders, such as between China and India or in Armenia. Because as I think the economic situation gets more tense, there's more of a drive for countries to try, you know, shore up their territory, shore up their stake in the world, which can lead to clashes breaking out at an increasing rate. The other thing is, I think that we are, this crisis will likely see us, or will likely usher in a new period of global capitalism, like all previous crises have before. So the crisis of the 70s led to neoliberalism, similar dynamics before that. I think it's too early to predict what exactly that will look like, and that will all be slowly worked out over the next few years. We'll be dependent on what happens in terms of class struggle, etc. But already, just in the past year, a bunch of neoliberal orthodoxies have been challenged. For instance, the level of state spending, the level of state spending on ordinary people is pretty unprecedented. The state of global supply chains were brought into question by the difficulty in accessing resources early on in the pandemic, and so on. Also, the crisis is likely to produce more political fractures within the ruling class and between ruling classes. Think of the explosion of populism, the troubles that the neoliberal centre faced over the past decade, etc. I think those dynamics will start to reassert themselves again. But finally, and this is a much more positive note, I think the other thing that this global economic crisis has and will continue to produce is struggle. Already in the second half of 2020, we have seen the return of the global rebellions that rocked the world in 2019. And a bunch of them, you can see, have been maybe not just caused, but really impacted by the pandemic, by the recession. So in Nigeria, Thailand, Belarus, the United States, part of what has fed the rebellion in those countries has been the failure of ruling classes to deal with this crisis effectively, but also the, you know, economic deprivation that a lot of people were forced into really, really, really quickly. So I am certain that we are to see more of those in the coming years. And just to finish, I think there are two things that are really terrible about economic crises under capitalism. The first is the devastating effects it has on ordinary people, who are the people forced to pay for the boss's crises. The second, I think, though, is that so far the ruling class have managed to haul themselves out of each one to then kick off new eras of exploitation that then lead to the next crash that fuck workers over again. I think these moments in capitalist history open up the possibility for a different kind of world. They open up, waves and waves of mass struggle. They open up the potential for people to resist in their millions all around the world, which is, you know, they're the snapshots we can see where it's possible to build a new kind of world, one that's not based on exploitation, one that is not based on recurring crises that periodically throw billions into poverty, but one that can be organised in a totally different way by ordinary people for ordinary people. And I will leave it there. Thank you, everyone. And I'm sorry about the technical difficulties. I'm pretty sure my computer overheated in this immense heat wave.